Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by AOL Radio at AOL.com/podcasting. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 91 for March 18th, 2007. All at Twitter. It's time to TWiT, and a fun panel today. In fact, a first for TWiT. We're doing it on TalkShoe as well, in front of a live audience. So what we're going to do today is do our usual TWiT roundtable, talking about the news of the day, and then we will open the lines to this TalkShoe audience, So if you're listening in TalkShoe to our live stream right now, go ahead and get in the queue, and we'll just go through the queue one by one. It'll take us about 45 minutes to get to that. Meanwhile, let me introduce the panel, because we've got a great one. In fact, two guys I've wanted to get on for a long time. One who's been on TWiT, I think, once or twice before, Robert Scoble, the Scobalizer. Hey, Robert.
Yay.
Yay.
Yay. How are you doing? I'm honored to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you. And I wanted to have you on to talk about South by Southwest, because I know you were there.
It was all barbecue, man.
In fact, at some point, I wanted to turn off Twitter, because it was basically that's all I was hearing was, you know, I'm having barbecue next to Dan Rather. I think that was Merlin Mann's
call. I got home and my wife yelled at me for saying Twitter. She said, if I ever say Twitter again around her,
no more
I'm sleeping on the couch.
Also with us, Alex Lindsay, who was also at South by Southwest from the Pixel Corps. Hey, Alex, good to talk to you.
Hey, I had barbecue too.
We missed you while you were gone.
I missed you too, Leo.
Yeah, we're glad you're back, man.
Alex is the host of many shows, including Mac Break Weekly. Of course, he's the head honcho at Pixel Corps. Now with their own podcast site, pixelcore.tv, which is linked directly from twit.tv as well. Since we're brothers in arms.
And it looks oddly similar to TWiT.
It does, but a better color scheme, I must say. I like your color scheme. I'm about to steal it. And now a fella I've wanted to get on TWiT for a long, long time, an old friend, and I think one of the real visionaries in this business, one of the authors of the Clue Train Manifesto. He is just a brilliant guy on this subject. Doc Searles, great to talk to you.
From great to be on, too. Thanks a lot.
Santa Barbara.
I'm hiding out in Santa Barbara, where normally it's beautiful, but today it's gloomy. So
You're teaching at UCSB.
I'm a visiting fellow at UCSB, or a research fellow, depending on which letter from which chancellor or something that we go by, which means I have a parking pass and half an office and a bunch of stuff like that. But I'm not teaching, no. I'm actually working in too slow a motion on a book, which if I talk about will make it go even slower, so I'll hold off on that. But that's basically it. And the interesting thing is I also have I'm a fellow at the Berkman Center at Harvard, which means that I get to savor relationships with two universities that never would have let me in as a student.
And two really prestigious programs to be
part of. They're great universities. Yeah. And it's the Berkman Center in one case, and to get a plug in, the Center for Information Technology and Society at UCSB. So
UC's doing some amazing stuff. We just interviewed a guy named Smar from UCIT2, which is the joint venture, I think, of UCLA and UC San Diego.
It's got a name like a droid.
Yeah, it's not a great name, but it's their media lab, and it's fascinating what they're up to. Just amazing. So neat stuff going on. So let's talk a little bit about South by Southwest, and then I want to get to the big story of the week, which, of course, is Viacom's lawsuit against YouTube. Did you go to South by Southwest, Doc?
No, I missed it this year. I decided to take time off from going to conferences, and actually, you know, after my kid... I have a 10-year-old boy who wanted my schedule so he'd know when I was home. I decided that was about the time to hold off on some of that, because I have to spend a week a month in Boston anyway. So,
Dad, can you sync your BlackBerry with mine? Because I can't figure out when you're home.
My kids have said things like
that. We don't let them use any of that stuff yet.
Oh, you will.
But anyway, yeah.
Robert has a ninth grader, or a seventh grader, I should say. Does Patrick use a BlackBerry or anything like that?
No. He has a little Sprint phone that he carries around.
Everybody has cell phones. Yeah, I mean, my 12-year-old has a cell phone. I mean, that's a given.
Oh, yeah.
I have to admit, my 12-year-old does not have a cell phone, but she has informed me that it is time for her to have a cell phone.
Father, it is time.
He wants an iPhone, but I can't justify a $600 purchase.
My daughter is working with a beat-up old Sprint phone, and I say, oh, let me get you a new one. She says, no, I'm waiting for the iPhone. You'll be getting me that, Papa. Hey, let's add one more voice to the conversation from across the pond. Will Harris from, formerly of, I guess he's still at BitTech, but now of willharris.co.uk. Hello, Will!
Hello!
Always, it's so amazing, the best quality Skype, and it's from Britain.
Yes, it works pretty well.
I don't understand it. And it's the middle of the night. Maybe that's why, because nobody's on Skype right now.
Nobody's online.
Yeah. Will, you didn't go to South by Southwest, I know that.
No, unfortunately, I was kind of stuck here being envious of everybody else.
Well, I was envious until I started getting inundated on Twitter with postings. Let's ask Robert a little bit about South by Southwest. What was the most impressive thing? What was your sense of what went on there?
The interesting thing was I asked hundreds of people, what have you seen anything cool? And nobody could come up with anything.
Really?
Yeah, it was pretty.
It's often said at South by Southwest that the most interesting things are what's happening in the halls.
That's true, but I was in the halls asking this question.
Nothing there either.
I think at South by Southwest, you just say, hey, y'all, let's go eat.
I guess Doc and I are pretty happy we stayed home, and Will.
I love going to South by Southwest, but you're right. It's a good conference surrounded by great food and great entertainment. So.
It's awesome. I mean, the barbecue in Austin is just, if you've never been to Austin, forget South by Southwest. Go to Austin for the barbecue.
I think we did the screensavers there once, and we went out, I think it was called State Line Barbecue. I think that was
a county line.
County Line.
I was at County Line earlier this week, and it is amazing.
They set a long table. Because it was Patrick, me, Martin, I mean, the whole gang, probably 20 of us, the whole production crew. Mm. They set a long table. They just said, sit down. And they just started bringing plate after plate after plate. And they kept coming.
I used to actually wait tables at County Line.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I always go back just to have the bread.
And then they took us back into the smoker, and my clothes still smell like pig. I'm not kidding. That thing is potent.
Yeah.
No, I mean, here's what South by Southwest was like. I was lying in the hallway. I was lying down. I actually have pictures up on Flickr of me lying down. And I was talking to Ethan Zuckerman, the guy who started Global Voices Online, which is an awesome blog. But it's not really a blog. It's more of an aggregator of blogs from all over the world. You can read what's happening in Zambia and Israel and Afghanistan, all over the place. And he just had come home from the TED conference, and he said that for the first time in years, he didn't feel like a rock star at TED, that the green movement was getting all the heat. You know, I mean, John Doerr, who was the VC of Google, was crying on stage about his daughter's admonition to him to fix the global warming thing. You know?
That seems like a meme that has really hit its stride thanks to Al Gore. And of course, Al Gore spoke at TED last year. Bill Clinton was there this year.
It's not just Al Gore. It's that there's no skiing. Things like that.
And you know, they're expanding now. You know, the TED is now doing TED Global, which is going to be another TED conference in Arusha, Tanzania, in early June.
I'd love to go to TED, but $6,000.
Yeah, it's too much money.
Yeah.
The TED Global is cheaper. It's only $2,600.
I think in many ways, South by Southwest really was the place to be rather than TED.
It's pretty amazing. It's actually the
next,
first time.
What's the next big conference? What's
It's actually unconference. It's no conference at all.
Unconference.
Yeah, I'm not kidding. We've had around the user-centric identity subject, we've had, and you know, there's no publicity around this. It's just a lot of technology development. But the biggest leaps forward that I've seen in technology have been at unconferences. These are basically places, events where people get together with a single purpose of anybody who feels like it raises a subject, and everybody breaks out into a table or a room.
Kind of like a bar camp?
It's like a bar camp is an example of one. But bar camps are generally general purpose. And most unconferences that are really good, like the blogger cons that Dave Weiner held, are you just see tectonic leaps forward, 1.0 to 2.0 levels of of geek progress happening at those things. But there's no, and it, you know, vendors don't run them, and big conference givers don't run them, and they don't have panels, and they don't have, you know, if they have PowerPoints, it's only to demonstrate something. They're amazing to me how well they work. And if you're trying to get something done, they're great. If you just want to have the usual, you know, probably South by Southwest or TED are some of the better ones of the remaining.
I mean, I think that one of the things that I heard while I was down there is, I mean, I spoke on one small panel and then went to a couple of other panels. And I think there was a lot of hunger for a lot more meat than what they were seeing at South by Southwest. I mean, I think there was a lot of good stuff, but it was just a lot of talking about things, you know, but not really getting to the heart of how to move things forward. I think a lot of people hope to get more information. That's what it seemed like for me, at least for the interactive conference.
Can someone tell me, I mean, the impression that I got of South by Southwest, like, not being there, was that there was a lot of very talented people there. I mean, the register of sort of, you know, Scobel and Zay Frank and all these video bloggers that are big, but not a lot of people, like, with sort of old school, old money influence and cash. And it seems like it should have been like a venture capitalist's dream conference, but it kind of wasn't.
There were definitely some venture capitalists floating around in there. I mean,
there were. I met a venture capitalist from AOL and a few others. The VCs are hanging out in the valley. I mean, they don't
aren't those the guys you want to keep out? Don't you want to have the guys who are doing something and not the money guys there?
South by Southwest's power is that it's people who actually build websites. You know,
yeah,
a lot of web designers, a lot of web developers. I mean, that's what I really like. That's who I really like meeting there. I go there to meet the CEOs and the money, you know.
One of the things that I thought was really interesting was that the wide range. You'd end up with little bloggers that are doing, you know, little bloggers or little podcast creators that are talking about stuff. But then
microbloggers.
But you also, in the same room, you'd have the head of Interactive for Discovery Channel, the, you know, Interactive guys from PBS. You'd have, you know, and everyone is still digging through trying to figure this stuff out. I also want to say that from a speaker's point of view, is probably the best run conference I think I've ever been a part of. As far as like giving me enormous amounts of information as a speaker, I had a place I had to show up. I had to do, you know,
I was
a lot
impressed.
Of these.
I was scheduled to be on a panel, but had a bail at the last minute. But I was impressed up to the point where I bailed with how in contact they were.
Yeah, really, really tightly run. And I speak at a lot of these things, as all of us do.
Do you think that the problem with a conference like this is that stuff's just moving too fast? By the time you've put together a presentation on it, something new. Well, look, I'll give you an example today. 4 hours ago, Twitter Map went up. Twitter Vision went up, which is David Troy's live Ajax Google Map mashup of Twitter Map. Now, that just happened 4 hours ago, and it's the rage right now. And it's probably moving like a brush fire through the Twitter community. And it'll be gone tomorrow or in a week. I mean, how can you cover this kind of stuff at a conference?
Well, I think that also there's a lot of pressure when you're putting together a panel that you want to have the names that are going to attract the names and the companies that are going to attract a lot of people to the panel. And sometimes what you really want to hear from are the guys that are in the trenches going, okay, this is how we're actually putting this stuff together. They're not as impressive to see, you know, they're not as impressive to, you know, you're not sure if that's a name that's going to drag people into a room of 500, but they're the ones that can really tell you how they're actually piecing this stuff together and making it all work. And I think that sometimes, you know, that's a hard thing to kind of, you know, to kind of figure out.
I have never been to South by Southwest, but we've done coverage of it. Amber was there last year, and my sense of it was it had this great gathering of the tribes feeling last year. It was almost a hippie fest where people who are making a difference, who are doing interesting things, get together in a completely altruistic fashion. It's not particularly competitive. Is that a mistake on my part? Was it like that last year? Was it like it this year?
It really felt
like that.
Yeah.
I was there last year, and it had a little bit of that to it to me, but mostly it was, you know, a gathering of the, you know, mostly people I already knew and really like hanging out with, and some people I like to meet and hang out with, and a bunch of panels that are all the usual. And, you know, and it had the problem that all conferences have, which is that panels are mainframes, you know, they're old, they've got tail.
So is the unconference more of that kind of gathering of the tribe kind of thing?
It's less tribal. It's very practical.
Interesting.
I mean, there's fun to it, but, you know, in the open source world, which is which I cover, I can't say I really work there as much, but which I cover, there's this saying, show me the code. You know, right. We could be as friendly as anything, but if you don't have the code, you don't really contribute, you know. So there's this culture of contribution that really matters. Now, the contribution doesn't have to be code. The contribution could be standing at a whiteboard and having some interesting things to say, but they are inherently constructive rather than just instructive. And that's sort of the big difference. The conferences of the old sort are instructive, but it's like school. Like you said earlier, that, you know, a topic like the, you know, the Twitter thing can blow through like a brush fire, and that's inherently transitory. It may be important, but it has too short a lifespan and too fast a movement to be treated in an instructive way. And that's the model of the old conference. It's school, you know. Somebody's in the front of the room. You sit still. You receive. They transmit. There's a curriculum. There's a whole, you know, there's published works that have the whole syllabus in there. And it's bull at this point. I mean, it's really old hat.
Yeah, but the old school conferences are coming back with entertainment. I mean, Kathy Sierra gave the keynote at South by Southwest and did a talk that really wasn't that instructive. I mean, I didn't learn all that much that I could take home and really use like a physics lecture. But it was entertaining because of the imagery she used on stage and because I knew who she was.
Yeah, but that sounds like almost a waste of time then. I mean,
well, it's not.
Actually, Bruce Sterling gave a closing talk last year. That was one of the most moving things I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah, well, he's amazing. I mean, anything he says, I will listen to. And
it's not, though. And even if entertainment is about seeing people you know and you like and seeing them in a different context trying to do something for you. You know, I don't think that's a bad thing either, to go and see Doc Searles give a keynote somewhere and listen to him. And yeah, you might not take away that much that you wouldn't have been able to learn on his blog or on his book, in his books. But, you know, seeing him face to face and being able to get him to sign a book or something like that is a big thrill.
Hey, you mentioned, well, I think that, go ahead, Alex, and then I'm going to move on to another
really
subject.
One of the things that I think that would be really, really fun would be to see this kind of unconference, which I admit, like I did the unconference in Pittsburgh, you know, for podcasting, but seeing something like mixed with some of these big conferences as a kind of a happening at the same time to give you that kind of on the ground.
Well, it's kind of how the birds of feather meetings usually are like, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that would be a nice to start to mix those two together because
South by Southwest had Barcamp.
Was there a Barcamp going on at the same time?
South by Southwest had Barcamp.
Yeah, they always have a Barcamp.
Barcamp was...
And the music is really good, too, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's Robert, did you get to the bar camp there?
Oh, yeah. It was awesome. I mean, in one corner was Matt Mullenweg, who started, you know, WordPress, giving a little talk to 15 people. And in another part, Microsoft was giving a little talk about expression. And in another part of the bar was, I don't know, Chris Messina talking about something I didn't even hear about.
See, I'd love to be at something like that. Forget the rest of the conference. That's what I'd like.
That's my main regret not going there is actually missing the bar camp.
Pretty amazing.
Which is great last year.
So one
and they had free burritos, which were awesome.
You back to the food, Robert. I worry about your
priorities.
Last time I saw Doc, he was on Atkins. You still on the Atkins? Is it working for you?
No, I lost 25 pounds and I found another 30. So
that's a way of doing that, doesn't it?
Yeah, it has a way of doing it, you know, and probably Southwest has something to do with it.
Get on the fat log movement, man. It's
hard.
Logging.
So somebody mentioned Zay Frank, and I guess Zay Frank presented both at TED and South by Southwest, but he's retiring. Yep. What's going on with Zay?
He's closing down his video blog. His video blog was a year-long show, and his last show was yesterday. So you can go to zayfrank.com and see his last show. And he told me that he's going to take a little bit of time off to fix his website and do some projects that he's been sort of holding off on. And then we'll see whether he comes back. I'm sure he's going to come back with more content.
Well, I applaud him. I think but I mean, doing a daily show is tough. And he was consistently creative, funny, clever. I'm amazed he was able to do it as long as he was. And I applaud him for saying, hey, I'm done now. I'm going to move on to something else.
He was the best thing off TV, I thought.
I agree. I think he might have been the best thing, including what's on TV.
Yeah, I agree.
And I don't know how he did it without blinking. Maybe he just wanted some time off to blink.
Well, edit.
He doesn't blink very much, even when you meet him in person.
Well, that's interesting. So that's very interesting. Anyway,
he wrote me an email one time and said, blinking is for pussies.
That's his slogan. Well, go see. I mean, the good news is there's a large body of work there that if you haven't seen it, you have a chance to see it. If you have, you can see it again.
I have to admit, I was a latecomer to the whole movement of Zay Frank, and it was just such great stuff. And I agree with you. It's just so hard to believe that someone could do that day after day. Yeah.
Yeah, the show on the 13th, by the way, is really a one that you should watch, and he's not even on it. He asked his reader or his listeners or viewers or whatever they call them to send in video of their own, and he got 1,000 videos, wow. And he put the best ones up, and I think it's like 20 minutes. I forget how long it is. It's a pretty long video, but it's just
34 minutes.
His viewers. Yeah, it's awesome. It's the best. It's probably the best video I've seen on the internet. You know, and it's all normal people saying what Zay meant to him over the last year.
He encouraged. It was really encouraging to see him because he kind of lived up to that notion that the net should be doing something different, not just another TV show, or not just another radio show or newspaper article. It should be something new and different, and he kind of made that happen. Moving on to the biggest story of the week, Viacom sues Google, pulls a little Dr. Evil for $1 billion. They claim 150,000 copyright violations. They claim a lot of money made by YouTube and, of course, by its parent company, Google, on these copyright violations. And they say, we want our share. What does this mean? Doc Searles, why don't you kick it off?
Oh, boy. Yeah, I've actually sort of avoided the topic because the way I see it is a company like Viacom, which is an entertainment company, it's Hollywood, essentially, employs entire buildings full of lawyers that do nothing but things like clearing rights for everything. And I can't imagine that any industry as driven by their legal departments as the entertainment one is could stand still for very long while pockets as deep as Google's were walking around owning what they would see as copyright violators. That's sort of the public side of it. The private side of it is the same as whatever it was that happened between Cisco and Apple over the iPhone name. They'll work it out in private, whatever it is. It's a negotiating ploy. And, to me, it's almost a it serves as a kind of smokescreen for what really matters, which is the absolute need for copyright reform, which won't happen until the geeks get behind making something happen and become as strong a lobbying force as Hollywood is right now.
A couple of different point of views from PC Magazine. Editor Lance Ulanoff said Viacom's making a big mistake. They could destroy perhaps the best publicity vehicle Viacom ever saw in YouTube. Jim Lauterbach disagrees and says that, in fact, Viacom's lawsuit was not only necessary. He does agree in the one respect that it could be very bad for YouTube. Actually, I guess Lance believes that YouTube will survive, will triumph over this.
I don't think it's bad for YouTube. I don't think it's bad for Viacom either. I mean, Viacom had to protect its existing business model. But YouTube, the magic of YouTube is go back to that Zay Frank video that played on the 13th of this month, where he had 1,000 people write, video in their videos. That's where the opportunity is. And what Viacom did by suing YouTube is just close itself off to that opportunity. I think they built a box around their business model, and that's fine. They're going to get the $1 billion. Google can afford it. Google's gone up, many times since they bought.
Here's the larger fear, though, is that a court's going to. And this is what Mark Cuban says, that the issue really comes down to this safe harbor provision in the DMCA. Is Google protected by this safe harbor, which is intended to protect internet service providers and web hosting companies, or is YouTube really a media company, which Viacom claims? If a judge decides YouTube's a media company and is responsible for protecting and finding copyright violations, doesn't that cause a big problem, not just for YouTube, but for this whole industry?
Well, I mean, a lot of people have compared it to the old Napster scenario, which is where, Google is basically saying what Napster said, which was, well, we just provide a service and people can put legit stuff on it, but if people put, illegal stuff on it, that's not really our fault. We're just hosting the service. And of course, you know, I think the Napster and the, you know, the Nutella and all those kind of guys fell on the sword on that one. I don't know why Google is going to be any different.
There's a lot of PR danger for, I think, for Viacom, being given the kind of content, a lot of the kind of content that they do with Comedy Central, MTV, VH1, so on and so forth, of looking extremely uncool. And, yeah. And the problem is that their business is based on looking cool, and they have now just smacked a large number of their viewers are now being, you know, watching something that they spend a lot of time watching, getting smacked on the head. And I think that can be, you know, very, I think overall it can be dangerous for them in that area.
Lance brings up some interesting stats. He says ratings for CBS, which is a Viacom properties, late night shows have gone up. And he believes, and I think you can make a good case, that it's because of these clips on YouTube. I'd never even heard of Craig Ferguson until I saw him on the Late Late Show on YouTube. That show is up 7%. The Late Show with David Letterman up 5%. I mean,
absolutely. And you got to remember the influentials in the industry are on the internet. And so if they see something cool on YouTube getting popular, they're going to write about it and talk about it and tell their friends and blog about it and Twitter about it and, you know, IM about it and email about it. And because Viacom has decided to pull everything off of YouTube and therefore put a chilling effect across the entire industry, they're not going to get talked about anymore. I'm going to watch Zay Frank rather than watching a Viacom video.
Well, this is what you've been saying, Alex, all along about the record industry, that by clamping down, for instance, as they are now on internet radio, all they're doing is hurting themselves by forcing people to turn to independent artists.
Well, and I think that also this really opens up a lot. We've talked about this a little on This Week in Media of, if they really push this down the path and they really force the courts to make a decision and the courts vote, for instance, go against YouTube, one of the things that happens is that it's very, very hard to get the copywritten material out there except for what they think is the best way. But the problem what people are going to might go towards, especially as we see this huge competition between Apple TV, Xbox, PS3, Juiced, all these other companies, what you may start seeing is a lot more content that is not controlled that way, easier to find, easier to get to, and getting to a point where it's almost just as good. And that might be enough for people to just stop watching some of the copywritten stuff. They could be slowly killing off their market. That's all.
Pandora. Yeah, I would add that what happened with internet radio was the end, the most recent event in the history of copyright lawmaking that began even before the DMCA with the 1996, with a variety of things that happened in 96. In any case, it was a decision made by the Copyright Royalty Board, which nobody even knew existed until a couple weeks ago when the decision came down.
You wrote a blog post on Linux Journal, which I thought was really right on. Internet radio on death row.
Right, no, it's a death sentence. It's the way people, you know, think Hollywood doesn't get the net. In the sense of fear, they get it in an enormous way. They got it early on, and they saw that what was going to happen with the net was that it was going to eat all of media as it was known. And what they wanted to do, once radio came along, once radio happened on the net, they wanted a deal with radio that would be much better than the deal they got with radio in the 1930s, when only composers were compensated through EMI and CSAC and BMI, and the performers were left out. So they went out of their way to have internet radio defined not as radio, but as a performance like you might find at a club. And created a bunch of lawmaking that basically said, this is for admission only, and it's going to be something we'll define as, well, you know, anybody who listens to these, what they call perfect reproductions, if it was digital, it was perfect, even if it was only 24K, that anybody who listened would have to pay, and that would be the business model. They decided what the business model would be in 1996, and that passed in the fall of 98, and then... But because they left it open to negotiation between webcasters, which barely existed in 98, but had actually gotten pretty well underway by 2001, they left it up to negotiations between those parties. But the webcasters were very weak lobbying-wise, and they were very weak lawyer-wise, and they got pretty much clobbered. And then they were saved only by Jesse Helms at the last minute on the behest of the religious broadcasters, who wanted the nonprofits to remain protected. And NPR and non-commercial stations were to some degree protected by a separate carve-out, it was called, that was very hush-hush and secret. And that deal got revealed by the Royalty Board in their decision like three Fridays ago. And now, of course, NPR is suddenly in the same bucket as all of these little webcasters that are kicking around out there. And they kind of saw that coming. I was at NPR a few weeks ago, and they were kind of looking forward to something bad happening there. Nobody expected it to be as bad as it was. But it is a death sentence. It basically says, your business model is X, and it's going to be too expensive. And it, you know, I said in that piece, it recalled the Vogon's decision to wipe out the Earth and, you know, to put the notice on Alpha Centauri and blame the Earthlings for not picking up on it. It's a ludicrous thing, but there it is. I'm hoping that, you know, that some of the geeks will get crazy about it and help wipe out that legislation.
SaveOurInternetRadio.com seems to be the locus for a lot of this conversation. SaveOurInternetRadio.com. It's appalling.
I think that artists, though, you know, can start really thinking about whether this is the kind of people they want representing their music. And more artists are going more independent, and they can make decisions about where their music ends up. I know we've been looking at doing some podcasts that are really geared around, you know, independent labels and independent music. And, you know, we've had no problem. We call the record labels directly, the ones that are not part of the RIAA, and make requests based on that. And if it's not covered under some of those pieces, we can just, you know, we're able to use that music, and we're able to do those pieces. Now, how long will it take for that to become organized and large enough to be useful? I don't know. But if it keeps on going down this path and it's hard to listen to it on a radio that we don't listen to anymore, I mean, every car I get into now, I rent a lot of cars, and every car I get into now has an 1/8-inch jack. And I don't listen to the radio anymore. I mean, I plug my iPod in and I go back to whatever I was doing, you know, and I don't have any reality of listening to the radio at this point. So I think that there's, once again, this could be another example of the industry cutting its nose off to spite its face.
In other words, you see this as an opportunity for the independent artist.
It's a huge opportunity because, if the independent labels and the independent artists seize on the fact that the large labels are cutting themselves out of the system and find ways to make it easier for these companies to get a hold of their music, sort through their music, so on and so forth, I think that they can make big inroads into a market that's just about to become more and more open.
And I think that's where YouTube is going. If YouTube can't show off the Viacom content, what are they going to show off? And there's still a huge audience checking out YouTube every morning. You know, they're going to show off Zay Frank and all the cool kids, all the new kids who are showing off little home videos.
Well, I think we're going to see
a lot of people are going to, absolutely.
I think we're going to see YouTube getting very organized about producing new content that's on YouTube that is well produced and designed and so on and so forth. I mean, there's a lot of rumblings going on about that. And so, you know, they're right now that they've got this huge audience, and hopefully they'll make the turn faster than Napster made, which is Napster didn't make the turn fast enough. And hopefully if they get to a legitimate new content available on YouTube, they could cause a lot of damage.
Well, as I remember, what happened to Napster is that the judge required them to put in a technology that would capture copyrighted material and keep it off their network, and they couldn't do it, and they had to go out of business.
And Napster was a single point that could be attacked. To me, the interesting thing that happened after Napster was the open protocols that allowed anybody to share with anybody and made it impossible to stamp that kind of stuff out. I mean, do all of you use BitTorrent by any chance?
I mean, admit it. Yes, of course we do. We all
use it. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Well, BitTorrent is stunning. I mean, you know, one of the things I said at this public broadcasting conference a few weeks ago was, you know, at some point, you know, the PBS can just put Frontline, make that the alpha seed on BitTorrent, and why even have transmitters anymore?
Right.
I mean, it's...
Well, we push on these podcasts, on Twit, we push 44 terabytes a month, which I just recently found out. We're fortunate because we get that donated by AOL and Cashfly. AOL
very
radio.
Fortunate, Leo.
Yeah, very fortunate, because AOL just told me if you were paying for this, it'd be over 40 grand a month.
Wow.
We couldn't do it. But when we first started, because we didn't have those relationships, we used BitTorrent. And it's not ideal because it's difficult to use, you can't just click a link and so forth, it certainly is. Would it be the solution if we lost our partnerships? You bet.
But then, just to bring it back around to where we started, I mean, YouTube really is a single point of failure. And if a judge comes in and says, look, install the filtering, or you know, you're in total breach and they can't install the filtering, we're back to the Napster situation.
Yeah, but wait. How many companies are out there that are Viacom? 5 or 6? So now we're talking about $6 billion. Google can survive a $6 billion round of lawsuits, and they'll come out smiling.
So do you think they'll
look
settle?
How much money is going to be spent in the next decade or two on advertising on this thing?
Will they come forward and settle, and then because they don't want the judge to make any decision about whether they're a ISP or a media company?
I don't think they'll settle. I think they're going to go all the way.
They'll fight.
I think
the risks are mitigated already. They've already made their money off of this thing. They've already gotten a brand love that YouTube brought them. They've already gotten the equity out of it. They're going to go all the way with this thing.
And meanwhile, Chad Hurley's going, whoosh. Whew.
Yeah, well,
yeah, no
look
kidding.
At,
that was close.
Well, they wouldn't have sued Chad Hurley, but they'll sue Google because right. Chad didn't have the pockets.
Well, look at what's going to happen in the next 2 years between now and the end of this lawsuit. 200 or 300 million people are going to get video cameras on their new cell phones. Are we going to not see another Zay Frank out of the next 2 years? We're going to see like 50 million Zay Franks.
Well, that's kind of the same point that Alex has been making, which is that this is merely in music or in video, it's just an opportunity for the independent. And if you're currently not independent, you might want to start thinking about being independent.
And I have been meeting with a variety of artists that are pretty well known in Hollywood, you know, talking about, you know, they're trying to figure out what they're going to do, and they don't really have a whole lot of interest in working with Hollywood anymore. They can smell blood. I mean,
Rodriguez, you're not going to make another Hollywood picture. Why bother?
Yeah, I mean,
on Friday night, I was sitting at Robert Rodriguez's table at the Austin Film Society, and his crew is totally into this stuff, and his crew is totally into disrupting Hollywood. I mean, that's what he's been doing. Robert Rodriguez, for those who don't know, is the guy who did the Spy Kids films and other films, and he's doing it for, you know, a fraction of the cost of an average Hollywood show. He gets stars to come on his shows because he takes them only for a week instead of a month or 2 months. He's a brilliant guy. Everybody should pay attention to him a lot more.
And by the way, the biggest cost is not always the stars. It's really the legal departments, and it's having to deal with the big old corporate interests. If you can work your way around that,
yeah,
you're better off.
Yeah. I want to remind our listeners on TalkShoe, we are streaming this live at TalkShoe.com, that we will be taking calls in just a few minutes. So if you call in and get on the queue, if you have a question about any of the topics we've talked about, you'll have a chance to talk with Doc Searles, who is with us, Robert Scoble, Alex Lindsay, and Will Harris. This is the first time we've done this on Twit, and it's kind of an experiment. We'll see how it goes.
But by the way, Leo, I got an IM from a friend in Scotland who says, tell Leo to stop being so funny on Mac Break Weekly as I keep laughing out loud while listening on my iPod.
He must like public. He must like my Shrek imitation. That's what he likes.
I guess.
A podcast is like an onion. So any other big stories we want to get to before we go to the calls? Anything else happened this week that any of you think is worth bringing up?
Well, this week was CeBIT in Germany, which is one of the biggest tech conferences in the world if you're a kind of equipment manufacturer.
It's a huge event.
Absolutely massive. I mean, it's, you know, to walk from one side to the other, you're talking some serious mileage.
Did you go, Will?
I didn't, but I had a bunch of guys that went out to cover it. And there was a few, you know, a couple of interesting things there. There weren't many big announcements. I think we were expecting both ATI and NVIDIA to come out with new graphics cards, and neither of them did because they're all delayed. But we did see the return of Commodore.
I was going to say, the Commodore game machine.
If you guys
machine.
Remember the C64,
yeah.
They're back with a new line of sort of elite gaming PCs.
Now, before you get all excited, this is no more Commodore than Packard Bell was the radio company, right? I mean,
absolutely.
This is a company that bought the Commodore name a couple of years ago.
But they're trading pretty heavily on the history, and they're saying, you know, these things could be, you know, collector's history, and they got the big Commodore logo on the side, and it's like, and you get a Commodore 64 emulator.
Well, there you go. That's all I need. I'm going to use my dual SLI cards to run Chopper Command.
C64,
yeah,
right.
I'm excited, yeah. So these were pretty heavy-duty machines, it looked like, according to the specs.
Yeah, and they got some nice, you know, nice artwork on the side. Looks all fancy and modded and, you know, whatever.
Cool.
The C64 was known because it had 64K of RAM. Will the new Commodores have 64 gigs of RAM?
I think they got about two.
Oh, okay.
Standard stuff.
All right. Samsung is going to start shipping hybrid hard drives. We mentioned that actually from BitTech, but now we've seen an announcement of a 32 gigabyte all solid state hard drive from SanDisk. 32 gigabytes. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Can you say MacBook Lite?
It'll be an SATA. Do you think Apple will adopt it?
Well, that's the rumor, isn't it? Well, the rumor around the Mac Rumorville. I guess someone used that table that you had last week, right, to make a new rumor. And that it's going to be a MacBook, you know, kind of mini light thing with all flash storage.
Let's open.
It sounded like,
go ahead, Alex.
I was going to say, it sounded like Apple, one of the rumors was connected to Apple being able to put your startup, basically a lot of the startup information that you needed into a flash drive so that your startup is almost instant. So it still has a regular hard drive, but it also has flash memory that it can go back to. So it
sounds like the Vista Ready drive.
Something like
that. And have you seen that TechCrunch has made a big announcement about its business?
There's a new CEO.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting.
What does that mean? I don't understand what that means.
It means they're going to start going and acquiring companies soon, because that's what she does.
How could Arrington have that much money? I don't understand.
He's going to get funded. I think in the next month he's going to announce that he's getting funded.
But then you've got to say, well, wait a minute. TechCrunch is known for covering Web 2.0 companies. Now their business model is we'll cover Web 2.0 companies and we'll buy them?
I think it's bigger. Yes. I think it's bigger than that. But yes. But I think it's bigger.
Well, how can you trust them anymore in their coverage?
I don't think they're going to buy Web 2 companies. I think they're going to buy other media companies. The opportunity for media right now is really interesting. And, you know, why couldn't they buy something like Blogger, for instance, and get a whole another thing going? Or why couldn't they buy, you know, a parenting website like Maya's Mom or something like that?
You have any insight into this, Doc?
Not really. It makes sense to me, and I'm not even sure if I can tell you how. I mean, I guess if you look at TechCrunch as a mechanism for having a really good finger on a pulse,
yes.
And if you assume that people are not going to trust that finger and that pulse less just because they're busy acquiring companies,
well, I will.
Yeah, well, you may be more discriminating than the average bear.
I mean, I think that really muddies the waters. What are they? Are they journalists or are they?
But then but then every media company has that dichotomy. I mean, every journalist working for a magazine has had a colleague who has acquired.
Yeah, but
that's what they're hoping is that Arrington is going to be the journalist. Right?
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah, so Mike is just going to be the journalist, and Heather is going to get on with the business of business, really.
Tell us about Heather. Who is she?
Well, she used to be, according to the Post, mergers and acquisitions of Fox, and so bought a whole bunch of stuff into Fox Interactive.
So big media
didn't
player.
She buy MySpace? Wasn't she on the team that brought MySpace into Fox?
Yeah, and I think she then led on a whole bunch of stuff after Ross Levinson left.
Well, how big of a war chest could Mike have?
As big as whoever
he's funded
him.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that depends who funds him. I mean,
I'm a VC looking for somebody who's got his finger on what's going to be the next big thing, I would go to Mike Arrington and say, all right, Mike, you here's $1 billion. Buy me the next MySpace.
And I think he does. And you know, when I was over in Germany, what did we talk about it? Drinking beer in Germany. It was talks. It was TechCrunch. I'm sorry. It was not Twitter. It was TechCrunch.
We had a little bit of beer. We're talking about TechCrunch. What's wrong with that? All right.
Twitter was South by Southwest, but a lot of people watch TechCrunch, and I think Mike has something going. And I think if. You know, you look at Podshow, our PodTech's competitors, they got $15 million, or actually they've got $23 million so far. You know, Mike could get easily $20 million and start acquiring some interesting companies and doing some interesting things.
So Heather Hard joins, or Hardy, I'm not sure how she pronounces it, joins them at the end of the month. And how long before we see the first announcement?
I don't know.
30 days.
Pretty quick.
Yeah. Let's put a sweepstakes on it.
Pretty quick.
Yeah.
And who do you think it'd be? Will it be Facebook, Twitter? Who will it? Odeo's for sale? Dig, maybe? You know, Dig, I have to say, Mike's been very friendly all along with Dig. In fact, he was the one who said Dig ought to sue CNET.
No, I don't think he's buying any kind of company like that. I think Doc has got it right. It's all, you know, it's about media companies. It's about buying up.
Well, aren't they the new media companies?
And making a kind of blog network kind of thing of top blogs.
How much to buy PodTech, Robert?
I don't know. Let's talk offline.
What do you got?
I am not hiring a CEO, I'll tell you that. Let's go to the phones now. This is, again, something we've never tried before. We're going to try it right now. If you're in the queue, just hang in there. I'm going to make sure I've got all the buttons pushed right so that everybody can hear you. And
I mean, Jason Calacanis earlier was saying TechCrunch will buy CNET in 2 years.
And let Veronica run it, I think what Jason was saying, which is...
We should ask Jason.
That would be really smart, you know?
Well, Jason's on the talk cast, so...
Is Jason in here?
Yeah, he's going crazy.
Yeah, he's listening.
Oh, my God, I didn't see him. All right.
Yeah.
I've seen him on Twitter Vision a couple times.
Hey, Jason. Jason, are you there?
Oh, boy, he's barely audible.
Wait a minute, that's my fault. I got to twist some buttons. Jason knows about this. He has a studio now for the Calacanis cast. Hello, Jason.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Hey, Jason.
Hey. Yeah, so I can fill you in on the Mike Arrington stuff. He's not going to buy Web 2.0 companies. I mean, he's obviously growing his media business. And obviously, I'm partners with him on the TechCrunch 20 conference, so... You know, I've known about the Heather thing for a while, and she's just a great operations CEO type person who's going to be able to let him focus on editorial.
Old media or new media?
Well, obviously new media. I mean, the conference is obviously old media. And
I hear Viacom's a great price right now.
I don't think it's going to be going for Viacom or anything like that, but I will tell you guys that I checked in on my T-Mobile account today, and I went 2,300 messages over. And I now owe $236 in 1 week of Twitter.
And it's all Twitter, isn't it? Yeah.
Oh, I'm destroyed.
I can't believe you were you were using SMS on Twitter. I turned that off right away. I thought, my God, I mean, my phone was buzzing constantly.
I have the same problem that now I think Scoble has, which is so many people are adding me that there's no easy way to befriend them back. So it takes like an hour to do 100 people, and the servers are slow. And
oh, well, no wonder you got so many messages. You're befriending everybody who adds you?
Well, I feel like that would be the right thing to do.
No, it isn't. That's insane.
Jason is everybody's friend.
Oh, it's not insane, actually. It's awesome. It's such a fire hose of early adopters.
Yeah, it's too much of a fire hose.
Oh, my God, it's awesome. But I have
almost 2,700 people following me. I'm not going to have 2,700 friends. That's almost 2,800 friends now. I have 68 friends. That's how many friends. That's plenty of friends. No wonder your bill is so high.
I have 1,000 friends right now, 1,043.
I have 300 friends and like 700 followers.
Are you getting constant Twitters? What is the deal?
Absolutely. It's awesome. I mean, I'm seeing 1,000 people.
You guys are junkies.
My wife, I got in a fight with my wife last night over it. She was like, you have to put that down. We're having dinner. Like, what is going on your BlackBerry? I was like, it's Scoble. It's this person. It's that person. So I turned it off.
John Edwards, campaign guy, you know, John Edwards running for president, his campaign guy said I was pulling up his BlackBerry.
You what?
Filling up his BlackBerry. I was about ready to stop watching you at South by Southwest, Robert, because I was just getting so sick of it. It was like, I don't want to know any more about the show I am not at.
It's basically a never-ending chat room now. It's like we're just all in a chat room for 24 hours a day, and like the last thing I was doing before I go to bed is say goodnight and then wake up in the morning, say hello to Scoble. Dave Weiner's drinking his coffee. I mean, it's CB radio for Web 2.0 without the static.
But isn't that just IRC?
Just a bunch of fairies. That's what it is.
Actually, it's not IRC. It's IRC without the idiots, because if somebody turns idiotic, I unfriend them immediately, and they're gone. It's not like when I ran Leo Laporte's chat room.
But you're not supposed to have back and forth conversations, are you? I mean, that kind of defeats the whole purpose of Twitter.
Well, now you're sounding like Terry Hunt.
So I guess if what you're doing is having a conversation with some of the people.
Jason did a very interesting thing today. Tell us about your experiment. I thought that was quite interesting.
Yeah. I basically was watching the Knick game, and, you know, there's a lot of breaks. So I said, okay, I'm going to do Ask Jason, Ask Me Any Question. And I got about, like, 30 questions in 10 minutes. So I started answering them. And then Jason Schellen, who was partners, I guess, with Ev and those guys on Blogger before they did Twitter, was like, that's it. I'm done. I'm leaving Calacanis. This is too much. You know, and, you know, it was pretty funny. But it definitely is, like...
I'll tell you,
a moving conference or something like that. It's weird.
I'm sure it's tongue in cheek, but you're talking about monetizing it, Jason. And that's when I started going, wait a minute.
Well, you guys think I'm joking. I think you guys should go check the internet for who owns Auto Twitter, Gadget Twitter, Parenting Twitter.
Everything
I bought about 100
name,
Twitter names.
That's it. I'm announcing,
100 Twitter names.
I'm announcing right now I'm leaving Twitter for all the people who I'm not using a Twitter anymore. That's it. It's all over. Forget it. Jason,
I'm starting a network of Twitter blogs.
Actually, 2 weeks ago, I said, who wants to meet at South by Southwest for dinner? And within 2 minutes, I had 30 people, and we had a great dinner at the South.
I think there's something to be said for that. I think that's kind of neat, this kind of locational Twittering.
And I announced that I'm doing a beach party on June 16th on Twitter, and already I have people from all over the world saying they're coming.
Well, who's buying Jason, aren't you buying a dinner if you... you lost the poker tournament, though. That's
I came in sixth place last night. If I won, I was going to buy everybody sushi. But somebody told me on Twitter that Jeff Pulver is a big poker player and that he's going to kick my butt. So I said, okay, fine, I'll play him anytime, anywhere, any amount of money, heads-up poker. So I think we have some betting going on Twitter.
And I saw Pulver now wants to put a big Twitter screen up at Vaughn, so that, which I think is a great idea for a conference.
I had to leave Jeff Pulver's thing because he was basically talking about his podcasting company like 20 times a day. And it's like the etiquette for Twitter, you don't need to tell everybody every blog post you're doing on your Twitter, you know?
Well, it's interesting because there's definitely disagreement about what is acceptable on Twitter and what isn't. I mean, I'm sure I violate all the time. It's rarely, I mean, there's no rules. Who knows what the rules are?
You know, it's working itself out. But anyway, great show, and I love this talk shoe thing. I'll get off so you can take another caller.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's great to talk to you, Jason. Really appreciate it.
The rules are you can do whatever you want in 140 characters. Huh?
As long as it fits in 140 characters.
That's the rule.
Avila Fame.
You can get a lot of rubbish in 140 characters.
You know, it's weird. Hey, Avila. We're doing this mixed drink show.
Hold on a second. Alex wants to talk about his mixed drink show. Go ahead.
No, we're doing it. We're doing the show on mixed drinks and for a network. And it was really funny. I was trying to explain to the host that she might want to think about being Twitter and trying to explain to someone who's not as techie on Twitter. Like,
you can't.
So you tell people about where you are and what you're doing. And she's like, and why would you do that? And
I tried to explain it on the radio show. And I'm halfway through the explanation and I realize this is not working.
Which is funny because she sends me, you know, I get like 4 or 5 text messages from her a day.
You know what? I think now if you show somebody twittervision.com,
okay,
just show them page. Just say, go to twittervision.com and say no more. I think that'll get the job done.
There we go.
Avila Fain, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Hi, how you doing tonight?
Very well. Welcome.
Andy from Phoenix again. Hi, how are you?
Hi, Andy. Andy, you must actually live on TalkShoe.
No, I just find you.
Uh-oh.
I find you.
Uh-oh.
A stalker!
I think I'm your stalker.
Which is very easy with Twitter.
Twitter makes it easy. You know my exact location. In fact, I accidentally put my my longitude and latitude to too great a precision, and people knew where my home is.
We've seen your house before on this French thing. Remember that thing you taped?
Oh, yeah. That's my old house. I moved after that.
That's scary. If you find Leo's house, my son's house is like 2 blocks down.
So, Andy, what's your question for our panel?
Well, I wanted to talk to Scobo. I know you worked at Microsoft for a little bit. Did you hear about the conventions that would happen this week in San Diego?
A Microsoft convention?
No, conventions.
I don't know what
you're saying.
Say it again.
But it's a convention. It was in San Diego. It was their Steve Ballmer's press conference earlier in the week.
Oh, nobody at Microsoft pays any attention to Steve Ballmer, do they?
Yeah, it was.
Do they? No, Scoble, come on. You're not there anymore. You can tell the truth.
They do.
Isn't Ballmer a joke?
Isn't that where they talked about the new CRM stuff and all that?
I put him on hold.
Yeah, it's the MVP Summit. You wrote the whole...
No. MVP Summit was up in Redmond. The other one... The other one was talking about SharePoint and enterprise.
Is Microsoft really? I mean, look at what we've been talking about lately. Is Microsoft even really an important player anymore?
Yeah, you know why? Because they have $60 billion in the bank, and they can buy something. In fact, didn't they buy something this week that was pretty interesting? Telio, right?
Yeah, they buy stuff, and it disappears. It sinks under the waves.
Yeah, it's not true. You know,
they
have
could be important and irrelevant at the same time.
Yeah, actually, that's true. I mean, they do have 95% of all the desktops. They just don't seem to know what to do with it. Maybe the
I think they're not doing well with the bleeding edge. They're doing very well with serving their existing customers.
Look, but Live is such a failure.
Actually, it was terrible.
I don't know. I love their maps, by the way.
I do too. They have some, and look, Live. There's some great stuff on Live. It's a failure.
Yeah. Well, has it started yet? Is it?
I rest my case,
Robert. I don't know.
I rest my case.
It seems like it's about 85% promise. Is that still the case, Robert?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you had a wonderful roster of things that weren't done over and over again.
It's, yeah, it's quite
it's amazing.
Amazing.
So many smart people are leaving Microsoft, I just hear a lot of frustration from inside Microsoft that they can't ship stuff.
Get more on mic, Robert, because you're kind of fading away in the distance.
I'm sorry.
There you go.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah. We hear you. You just
like
you sound like
can
you're.
Can you hear me now?
You're just yeah right. No, that's Verizon. But anyway, go ahead.
Verizon. You know, there's just a lot of frustration coming from inside Microsoft. I mean, there are parts of Microsoft that are clicking pretty well. You know, the Xbox team is doing fairly well. The business side of Microsoft, you know, the CRM, which is what the caller was talking about, is doing very well. You know, they own business, and nobody is going to sell that part of Microsoft for a long time, no matter what Google tries to
do. Good point. You know.
Yeah, Google might move into their turf, you know, over the next 5 years, but I just don't see them being assailable on the business side. The thing that I follow is the internet and the consumer space, and they're really struggling to get traction. And
maybe that's it, is that we're much more interested in what's going on in the consumer. I am, anyway, much more interested in going on.
I am. I mean, I'm not interested in SQL Server. I mean, right. SQL Server makes billions of dollars for Microsoft. Right. And Exchange, you know, which is real important, makes billions of dollars and is really attractive. Even continued for even our startup is looking at Exchange instead of Google's email server. But, you know, the stuff that's really attractive to me is the consumer side stuff and the website stuff. And there, Microsoft really has not had a good strategy going.
I mean, I think you're quite right that a lot of people say, oh, you know, what's Microsoft doing? And Microsoft is going downhill and Microsoft is in trouble. And, you know, I think the thing is that Microsoft is so, so massively successful in that kind of business arena. And it is no doubt going to make billions and billions of dollars over the next 3 or 4 years from Windows that it can afford to keep having a lot of goes at getting stuff right until it does get stuff right. So it's not going anywhere.
And they can afford that about them, and something we get done right. But name something lately that they've been going at, and they
silence strikes it.
Well, actually, I can name something. What they're doing with identity is leading, or certainly participating in a very big way in the user-centric identity conversation.
When you say identity, you mean OpenID, or what do you
no,
mean?
No, I'm talking about OpenID. They're embraced OpenID, and they were involved in the whole conversation that ended up with OpenID being as strong as it is. Their own effort called CardSpace, they're involved in an open-source effort around CardSpace, so there are non-proprietary versions kicking around out there that can interoperate with them, and so they can interoperate with OpenID. And that's brilliant work that's been done, but it's been done more at the rank and file level. I don't know if it's
well. That's always true at Microsoft. The individuals at Microsoft are often brilliant.
And that's been, you know, I mean, I speaking for the open source community, there's been a lot of very positive interaction with Microsoft around identity, and of course, it's one area, and it's not something you can point to and say, "Well, here's a product." It's really a feature that's part of other products.
And yet, you could say they fumbled Passport. I mean, they were there,
but it's because they fumbled Passport. See, that's the thing; they learned from Passport.
Right.
If the smoking corpse of Passport weren't laying around, Kim Cameron and the people in the identity group wouldn't have been able to do what they did.
Right. That makes sense. And I still have a Passport sign-on I try to use, but
it's still there. You can still use this thing.
It's pretty much ignored by everybody. Paul Ford. Let me go on to another call here, because I want to get as many people as we can. And Paul Ford, welcome to This Week in Tech. Hello, Paul.
Hey, Leo. Thanks for having me.
Where are you calling from?
Calling from Colorado.
And what can we do for you?
I was just wondering, with Twitter and everything, where does it go from here?
And where does Twitter go, or the web?
Just Twitter in general, because it's a pretty basic software. And
there isn't really much to Twitter, and I know that Ev is selling the rest of his business of Odeo and focusing on Twitter. What do you think, Robert? What would you do next with Twitter?
I have no idea, because it's the stupidest software you've ever seen, right?
It shouldn't be anywhere, and yet it is.
Well, the reason it is because all my friends are on it, right? And that's what really got me. I'm not a visionary, right? I'm not the guy who builds the software. I'm not Douglas Engelbart or Dave Weiner. All I do is look for doubling effects in society, on software. And around November of last year, the doubling effect kicked in where I noticed it. And I jumped in because I said, man, this thing is doubling every, couple of days or every 2 weeks. And that's what made it interesting to me. All my friends were on it. Everybody I care about, Ryan is on it, and my employees are on it. And so that told me that it was cool.
Doc Searles,
I have a question about Twitter before I answer anything.
All right, go ahead.
Is it a silo?
Yes. It's got an API.
No. Is it a silo? Does somebody own the whole thing?
Yeah.
Okay. Then it's terminal in the long run, for the same reason that even AIM and MSN or and all those closed systems are terminal. It's got to be. Needs open tech. Twitter is, and I confess to not knowing. Okay?
I can use my Jabber client to talk to it. In fact, that's how I talk to it.
Well, that's fine. I suppose if it's open in the sense that it's a Lego block that doesn't, if it's a Lego block and not a whole walled garden one has to go into it.
It's more of a Lego block, I would say, in that sense. It's
okay.
Because there's an open API, because it works with Jabber, it works with all SMS systems, it works with, it is much more open than, say, AIM is.
So in that sense, I've not tried it, but can I use it on my Linux client because I've got Jabber?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
I use it on my BlackBerry with Jabber, not with SMS. I mean, that's why I felt bad for Jason. I don't know why.
Oh, really? Wow, no kidding, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's crazy to use your SMS client. That's just nuts. I don't know what I agree with you, Robert. It's kind of hard to know what the next thing to build out of Twitter is. I was kind of surprised when Ev said this is where we're going to focus, because where do you go?
I mean, part of it is it's like an RSS client where every item is going to be 140 characters or less, right? So what kinds of things would you like to see in an RSS client where everything's 140 characters or less? How about traffic information? How about weather information?
Well, they've got that.
Stock boats?
They've got all that.
But that's just RSS, isn't it?
Yeah, they obviously.
I mean, you can just do that with RSS.
It is RSS, but because everything is guaranteed to be 140 characters or less, it affords certain kinds of information. And I certainly like getting headlines here better than I do in my Google Reader, because I like to see the full text in Google Reader.
Right.
It's interesting how there's two different usage models here.
Cyber Larson, welcome. You're next on This Week in Tech. Hello, Cyber Larson. Where are you calling from? What's your real name?
My name is Mike Duffy. I'm calling from Pawtucket, Rhode Island.
Grew up in Pawtucket.
Yeah, I think we might know each other, actually. You mentioned the street that you lived on.
27
I lived on Blodgett.
I lived on Glenwood Avenue.
I lived on Blodgett.
Well, I was like 6 when we moved, so I don't remember you, Mike.
Yeah.
It sounds like we're the same age. That's pretty funny.
You were talking about the way that they're trying to get rid of internet radio. Does that apply to the podcast too? I've been doing some. I have a podcast, and I wanted to add music to it. And from looking at the ASCAP and
forget license fees on music.
You
can't.
Me.
You can't play. Just forget playing licensed music on a podcast, because it's not even streaming. It's stored, and they charge through the roof for that, right, Dada?
Well, it's not what they charge. It's that, as bad as the rules are for radio, there are rules.
Right.
Unfortunately, for podcasts, it's a minefield. You are required to clear rights with every copyright holder.
Oh boy!
Now you can launder it. There is a way of laundering it, and that is by running it through an actual licensed over-the-air radio station. So there's a station in San Francisco called KYOU that's actually offered to do that. There are others. There are low-power radio stations. There are your college stations and so forth. I mean, if you could get a relationship with a with an FCC licensed station because they have their deals, right?
Right. So, that's how my podcasts are handled. But I have to say, why even do this deal with the devil? This is your opportunity. Play podcast licensed music. Play stuff from Podshow. Play stuff from Creative Commons. This is an opportunity to play indie artists who want to be on your podcast. Why play licensed music on a podcast?
Let me jump in on that. I was in radio for years. Okay, not for years, for long enough so that it's still athlete's foot, and I can't ever get rid of it. Right, there's still that in me that wants to be on the radio. It just galls the crap out of me that the enormous knowledge that I have of you know, old rock and roll, for example, even old classical music, some jazz, I can't use that on a podcast.
Yeah.
I mean, I love the fact that there lots of new music can be played, that independent music can be supported, and even that the insane license regime allows that to happen and, in fact, encourages it. But it aces out everybody whose expertise is in music that's licensed. It's this enormous pile of stuff that just can't be touched. It's in fact one of the reasons I don't podcast. I would love to use the music that I know, and the fact that I can't, just it feels like just extraordinary censorship to me.
And I think some of that, as we as participants in this whole process, some of this is up to us. If we start to say we're really not, I mean, if a lot of us, and I'm not saying that we will, but if a lot of us decided we're really just not going to buy anything from these guys anymore, we're really not going to play anymore because we don't want to do what they're, you know, we don't approve of this, we're really going to move. And if a lot of podcasters, if a lot of listeners, if everyone decides to take a decisive move to a certain direction, they'll have to react. And that's the thing that we're not doing, is we'll sit there and complain and hope that our lawmakers will fix it, which they won't, because they're getting paid by these guys to not do that. But what we can do as users, as producers, as all this, is to start moving the thing in a much more concise way, and then force them to react and open it up to a point that works for us, in my humble opinion.
I also have to say that this music restriction is great for talk radio and talk podcasts.
Oh, no doubt about it.
we don't have to worry about that. And, you know, that's why there's an explosion of talk podcasts. But, you made a really good point, I think, Doc. And there, some of the podcasts I loved the most were, in fact, people talking about real music, you know, licensed music, old music, and they're gone.
Well, and the fact is, you know, you can do it. I mean, you know, I've heard lots of podcasts that have licensed music on it, and the RIAA isn't going after them. The copyright holders aren't going. In fact, the RIAA probably wouldn't. Probably the copyright holders directly might. And they, for the most part, don't give a crap. But, I mean, in my case, there's just one item that I wanted to use as one song that I wanted to use as a theme song for my podcast. And I just hit nothing but dead ends in trying to find who owns the rights. It was absolutely impossible. KCRW, which is one of the top public stations that actually plays music in Los Angeles, probably the most forward-looking of the bunch, has a daily show called Morning Becomes Eclectic. It has an enormous listenership for public broadcasting program. And about one out of every 20 or 30 of their shows is actually on a podcast. They stream them every day, but is actually on a podcast because of this rights clearing issue. And even there, they're one of the stations you can launder on. They're being cautious about it. They're in Hollywood, right? They're a Los Angeles station, and they don't do it because it's such a huge pain in the ass to even begin to try and figure it out. Mm.
Let's say hi to Phil in Greenville, South Carolina. Phil, you're next on This Week in Tech. Hello, Phil.
Hey, Leo and the gang. You know, you're an hour into this thing, and no one's really talked about the Vonage and the Verizon deal much.
Tell us what happened. I didn't know about it. What happened?
Essentially, Verizon, judge says that Verizon has patents, and that that Vonage essentially owes Verizon money, and they said the tune is like $58 million.
Oh, that's good news for Verizon. Jeez.
5.5% of all future revenues, although it looks like Verizon's take is that they're trying to just put them out of business.
Wow.
Yeah, they play hardball, those guys. It's just...
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I'm not surprised. I'm surprised that they had these patents, but I'm not surprised that Verizon's going after Vonage. I mean, that's a big threat to any telco, and Verizon seems to be the most predatory of all of them. They're the ones who got Wi-Fi kicked out of Pennsylvania.
So if you check out, Business Week has got the story on this, which is basically that Vonage sued over five patents. Sorry, Verizon sued over five patents that it said Vonage was infringing. The jury said it only infringed on three and didn't do it willfully. And so they minimized the damages at $58
million. Jeez.
And it's and now Vonage has to pay 5.5% of its customer fee per month to Verizon.
Well, you have to think that's putting them out of business. I mean, they weren't in such great shape to begin with. So,
it's important to remember that these guys are inherently legal entities. They are not. They are, you know, they are. I think I'm pretty sure this is true. The telcos are the largest lobbying organizations on Capitol Hill.
Oh,
they're larger even than the pharmaceuticals. They live in a regulatory habitat. If they were outside a regulatory habitat and operating like a real business with real competition, and they weren't in this regulatory protectorate like a bunch of zoo animals, they would fail. But they live in this legal zone, and they win these kinds of things. It's really creepy and bad, but there it is.
Let's move on to Red Dragon 3883. Not his real name, I'll wager. Red Dragon, what is your real name? Where are you calling from?
Yes. My name is Felix. I call from West Lafayette, Indiana.
Great to talk to you, Felix. You have a question for the panel?
About Juiced and evolution of Next YouTube. What do you think?
It's interesting because Viacom made a deal with Juiced when they wouldn't make a deal with YouTube.
Yes, and now they are suing YouTube, isn't
right. it? I think the thing with Juiced is that it's ironically, given the people who are founding it, Juiced is very, it gives copyright holders an enormous amount of power. It's very encrypted, it's very closed, and they're only looking for really medium to large size producers. They're not looking for individuals. So it's not the next YouTube, really, because you're not, as an individual, we're going to be able to upload to something like Juiced. It is an exciting platform. You know, I mean, it's a pretty interesting.
It strikes me as in a way taking the old business model and putting it on the net. It's not exactly where I'd like to see the business model go.
Exactly, and I think they're fighting the web. I mean, when Podtech went to a player that you can put on your own blog, our traffic tripled. And why did it triple? It tripled because now you could put our stuff on your site or on your place, on your MySpace.
Hey, that's a good idea. I'm going to steal that idea.
You should, man.
I like that idea.
Best
I don't
thing
know
we've
why
done
I,
in the last 2 months.
So you just have a little embed thing. What was I thinking?
Yeah, but we stole that idea from YouTube, right? Why did YouTube become the media distribution center for the world? Because they decentralized. They let that player go on my blog so I could – you know, put a video on my blog without linking over to YouTube and making them richer. You know?
I don't know why I didn't think of that. I brilliant.
But that's fighting the web, right? The people, the companies that fight the web, the principles behind the web are and the movements behind the web are gonna be less exciting, less interesting. I like Juice because it looks cool, but I hate it because it looks cool. It's really hard to shut that freaking thing down. I almost said a bad word. You know, because if your boss walks in, you're watching video.
Oh, he knows it, too.
Where the hell is the close button on that window?
I don't think John Furrier is yelling at you for watching Juice. I certainly
No, he's not. John's a cool guy. I have cool bosses.
That'd be the last guy to be yelling at you.
But, but you know, normal people who work at, you know, normal companies have to worry about that.
Yeah, right. There's no boss button. Make note to
But I do think I think that Juiced is very much designed. I mean, what they're hoping to do, of course, is to build something that is like the next, you know, is the next TV. It's this hyperactive TV content, because when you look at what they're including, the ability to chat with other people watching the shows, the ability to get other interactive content. I mean, these are the things that they're, I'm not saying that they're going to be successful, but they are, it's not really designed to be the web in a player format. It's really designed to be TV with added interactivity. And, you know, and I don't know if they're going to be that successful, but I think that what's interesting for us as producers, and since I'm one of those, and for the consumers, is I think we're really about to see a nuclear war between, you know, about five or six of these big guys that are about to not CBS and NBC, but the Juiced, the YouTube, the
We've
Apple TV.
You've got to figure Verizon and AT&T want to be in that business too.
Well, what's interesting that we've seen is what well actually they actually are. a lot of what these cable companies are doing, the cable networks, so the Comcast, the AT&Ts, the Verizons, the problem with their cable offering is it's been pretty much commoditized. You know, you're just buying a cable subscription.
Channels. I don't even know who my cable company is. Exactly.
And a lot of them, though, is what they're moving towards doing, and a couple of them are really taking a forward push on this, is they want to buy a lot of their own custom content that's video on demand for their network. And I think that's what we're going to start seeing them do to differentiate their network from others, is they now have this big pipe. They can give you all this video on demand. They've been moving towards this IPTV, and that is exceptionally good for producers and really, really good for niche content being available. It's not so good for Hollywood because now suddenly on your cable network, it's not just Apple TV, it's not just Xbox, it's not just PS3 or Juiced. On your cable TV, you're going to be able to watch a whole bunch of these little short pieces. And these aren't pieces that are like YouTube quality. I mean, we are doing 5 shows right now for syndicators that are connected to, you know, a lot of the stuff that's happening. Or a syndicator, a company called On Networks. We're delivering at 1080p. You know, this is not, we're not making lots of little content. We are, they're ones that are finding those things, out. So it's an interesting time to be.
Well, I want to wrap
the consumer and a producer.
I want to wrap this up. I think we could go for hours. It's really been a fascinating conversation. I want to thank you. Alex Lindsay's Pixel Core is at pixelcore.com. And by the way, I think we still have some seats left for GMT.
There's a couple left for, and that it was really funny being at South by Southwest. It's like the exact opposite, where it's just all gear talk.
Our podcast seminar we're going to be doing end of the month in San Francisco. If you're going to be in San Francisco, please, we'd love to see you there. It's $200. Go to pixelcore.com to register, but do hurry because I think we're going to be full pretty soon. That's going to be March 27th through 30th. We'll be doing Twit There Live as well as MacBreak Live and MacBreak Weekly. And Scott Bourne will be there. Alex Lindsay and I will be all teaching. And I know Merlin says, can I come? And I think we will let Merlin in.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we'll let Merlin Mann in.
I'm very jealous.
You can come.
Come on up.
Come on, Robert. We'd love to have
come
you.
Come on up.
Come on up.
I want in on the party.
All right. It's going to be
come
fun.
Come on in.
Pixelcore.com. We'll find a special seat for Robert. Maybe we can get him to do a lecture or two on content. He certainly knows more than most.
Yeah, that'd be great.
And pixelcore.tv is the home for all the Pixelcore video casts, including a lot of those 1080p podcasts. Like
yes.
Netflix. Yeah, baby. Robert, what do you want to plug?
Scoble Show.
At Pod.
That's my video show.
Podtech.com.
I go around the world and interview cool geeks that Leo doesn't get.
It's very, very cool. Yeah, because I'm not willing to leave my my home in Petaluma, so that's why. I'm stuck here in my chair.
They come to you,
they
man.
They come to me, baby. Well, hey, this was a great panel. I was thrilled. I'm thrilled. Will Harris has a new blog. It is willharris.co.uk. What's the name of that again? It has a great name. The End of the World?
It's nothing. It's just called Where's Will?
Where's Will? That's it. Where's Will? Well, now you know. willharris.co.uk. And I'm so glad we could get Doc on the show. I've been a huge fan of Doc Searles ever since the Kluk Train Manifesto.
Well, thanks. Likewise.
Does such good stuff, and I hope you will come back.
Well, whenever you want, man. I'm available. Sure, I'd love to.
Well, now that Steve Gilmore no longer has his hooks into you, I'd like to get you on.
Well, he'll always have his hooks into me. It's just what he's going to do. Who
all
knows?
All right. Well,
Steve is not predictable.
Steve's working with me, by the way.
Is he really?
Yeah, he's telling me what to do now.
Well, I always wanted to get Doc on Twit. I always thought he'd be a great contributor, and obviously I was right. But because you were part of the Gilmore gang, I didn't want to break up the old gang. But now that they're on Hines.
These things are, it's not like old, team.
No, we all work together, of course.
Yeah.
It's collegial.
Yeah, exactly.
Collegial. Doc, what do you want to plug? Anything you got going?
Actually, what I'd like to plug is Project VRM. It's at projectvrm.org. VRM is the reciprocal of CRM. It's vendor relationship management. It's how the customer manages vendors rather
Excellent.
Than vice versa. It's my project, not just mine, but many people's at the Berkman Center at Harvard. That's where it's being headquartered. And that's the work I'm doing there, and it's actually just it's not my work, it's a lot of people's work, and it's a new idea, it's experimental, and it's something we're thinking out loud about. But anyway, go to projectvrm.org, it's just a wiki, but that means if you care about that, you can get interested in it and contribute. That's what we need.
I love the idea. We do need to manage our vendor relations.
Yeah, well, CRM is so broken. That's the subject of a whole show right there, but... And rather than complain and about what's wrong with the way customer service works, let's fix it from the customer side. That's the idea.
I agree. That's fantastic. The work in a way that you began with Clutrain.
That's exactly right. It's like I'm tired of like waiting for somebody else to fix that. Let's do it ourselves.
We are on twit.tv. That's the home of all the Twit podcasts. And, of course, we've got some great merchandise. Now, we don't really make any money on it, but it's you wanted it, and we've got it. We decided to go with the best in the business this time around. So we've got Scotty Vest doing the hoodies, the fleeces. We've got great hats with hidden pockets. And ThinkGeek is the fulfillment company. So you can either go to – actually, easiest, just go to twit.tv. That'll link you right through to ThinkGeek and the new Scotty Vest Twit merchandise. I wear it all the time. It's really nice stuff. While you're there, we do appreciate any donation you'd like to make. We don't really have advertisers, not through any choice of our own, but we do need to pay the bandwidth bills. Thank goodness AOL comes through for us and CashFly. But there are still plenty of other expenses, and your donation really helps keep us going. That's twit.tv. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks to TalkShoe for providing. I kind of surprised them. I ambushed TalkShoe, and they performed admirably. And I think this was such a success. We'll probably do Twit Live, if not from now on, much of the time from now on. So thank you, everybody on TalkShoe, for joining us. I'm Leo Laporte. Another Twit.
This Week in Tech
is in the can.
This Week.
C. Dvorak, Kevin Rose, Patrick Norton, David Prager, Robert Heron. I got the Twit Army behind me. Microsoft poo-pooed it. They denied it, said no problem. System. It's a fool's paradise.
This is amazing.
In tech.